of Geneva, the DePaul University Law School in Chicago, the Human Rights Institute at the Irish National University, Galway, and the University of Trier, Germany. At present, he teaches international law at the Geneva School of Diplomacy.
Oh, welcome to the program, Mr. DeZayas. Let's start off with your perspective on unilateral coercive measures, otherwise known as sanctions.
What must be clear to every listener is that sanctions kill. I mean, sanctions kill just as much as a bullet. Sanctions kill when you siege a town, like the Nazis siege Leningrad. That cost between 700 and 1 million human lives. Now, the sanctions that the United States has imposed on Venezuela are estimated to have cost, in the year 2018 alone, 40,000 deaths. Now, when you add all the deaths attributable to unilateral coercive measures against Cuba, against Nicaragua, against Venezuela, against Syria, against Iran, you're going to go into the hundreds of thousands of deaths. And this is not an exaggeration. UNICEF carried out an investigation of sanctions against Iraq back in the 1990s, and the estimate is that 500,000 children died because of the sanctions.
Wow, unbelievable. I mean, you say that sanctions are killing people. Can there be international legal measures taken against these sanctions?
In the light of worldwide deaths, certainly of more than 100,000 human beings directly attributable to United Nations sanctions, this is a matter for Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. This clearly falls under Article 7 of the Statute of Rome, the Statute of the International Criminal Court. That is the article on crimes against humanity. This is what has to be argued in the General Assembly. This is what has to be argued in the Security Council. This is what has to be argued at DESA and all other United Nations agencies. We already have the excellent reports of Alena Dohan. She is the UN Special Rapporteur on the adverse impact of sanctions, not only U.S. sanctions, also sanctions imposed by the United Kingdom and by Canada and by France and Germany, et cetera, et cetera. They all kill. And that is so important that the mainstream media pick up on this piece of news. As I say, my American friends know nothing about this. They know nothing about the fact that sanctions kill. They assume that sanctions are there for good reasons to persuade governments to cease violating human rights. So the hypocrisy of it, the, shall we say, the cynicism of it is mind-boggling. But that is the situation we are living in. So my appeal, which I make in my book, Building a Just World Order, is that this issue be before the International Criminal Court. But in the meantime, it can also go up to the International Court of Justice. Because the General Assembly, if you get enough votes in the General Assembly, so majority plus one, you can adopt the resolution elevating the question, the legal question of the illegality of unilateral coercive measures under the UN Charter and elevate it to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion.
But what do you think the overall goal is for Washington and its sanctions regime?
Our government, there is what we term the deep state. And the deep state is made up of the military, industrial, digital, financial complex. Essentially, they call the shots. And they're making money. They're making plenty of money with war. They're certainly making a lot of money with the Ukraine war. And they're certainly making a lot of money with the sanctions. So the sanctions is a way, for instance, to prevent countries to do free trade. and to buy cheaper where they can in the world. What sanctions have done, and people don't seem to realize it, sanctions have upturned, frustrated, subverted the benefits of globalization. Sanctions have essentially destroyed globalization and the supply chains and everything that goes with it. So that the United States, by weaponizing the dollar, is trying to impose on the rest of the world the U.S. imperial wishes. And as I said, I'm an American citizen, but I think like Noam Chomsky or like Jeffrey Sachs or like Dan Kovalik or Francis Boyle or Stephen Kinzer, who just abhor the weaponization of human rights actually to hurt people. And that exactly is what we're doing, but that with the complicity of the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CNN, Fox, and the others.
What can be done to counter these measures?
Until we realize that we are being lied to day in, day out, and that we are in the United States, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, we won't be able to make any progress. So what can we do? Certainly give it publicity in the General Assembly, certainly give it publicity in the Security Council, appeal to UNICEF to carry out an investigation of the deaths attributable to sanctions, appeal to the WHO to carry out an investigation of deaths attributable to lack of access to medicine. Similarly, an appeal to the Food and Agriculture Organization, and then elevate the issue to the International Court of Justice. Is this a crime against humanity? Does this amount to a violation of Article 7 of the Statute of Rome? I have no hesitation to say that it does.
Well, do you think that these unilateral sanctions help to create an alliance between those countries which have been sanctioned?
The mindset in Washington is still the mindset of the unipolar world. And the United States just simply is striking right and left and imposing sanctions and intimidating countries and actually engaging in terror against governments, and has an enormous responsibility, both civil responsibility and criminal responsibility, for the consequences of those sanctions. But there again, that is what I say, and what Richard Falk says, and what Jeffrey Sachs says. But that is not what you're going to read in the New York Times and in the Washington Post. And thus far, I don't see the American media changing. I see the American media as the spokes, as the spokesperson, as the sounding board of the Pentagon and the sounding board of the State Department. So don't expect any level of self-criticism inside the established media. You can read very good analysis in the so-called alternative media.
Are there any final comments you have on this, Mr. DeZayas?
You will see that there's plenty of Americans who think like I do. On the other hand, none of us is in a position of power. None of us is in a position that we can actually influence policy. And we can write our articles and write our analysis and hope that some people who are in a position of power will say, that makes sense. Why not try that? Why not shift? Why not try a different paradigm than the unipolar paradigm that we now have?
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Alfred DeZayas. As many countries continue to be affected by the sanctions regime, there's growing solidarity between many of the targeted countries and increased cooperation between them. These nations have had to be resilient and had to count on their own ingenuity to survive and, for many others, even thrive during these sanctions. And now it appears that the pendulum of global power is swinging, and it is heading towards the east. This should be a very interesting journey, and Hidden Files will keep you informed during this process. Well, it has been a pleasure being with you on this episode of Hidden Files, and hopefully you will join us right here next week. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Limelight.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Biden met on Monday, 22nd of May, resuming talks on how to avoid a catastrophic debt default as the 1st of June deadline looms. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Biden met on Monday, 22nd of May, resuming talks on how to avoid a catastrophic debt default as the 1st of June deadline looms. Kevin McCarthy said on Sunday that he had a productive telephone call with President Biden as the president returns from the G7 conference in Japan. McCarthy told reporters that ahead of Monday's meeting with President Biden, he hopes the negotiating teams on Sunday can walk through their exact positions so they can accordingly explain them to Biden. While House negotiators, including Steve Ricchetti, Shalanda Young, and Louisa Terrell, arrived at the Capitol shortly before 6 p.m. on Sunday to meet with Republican representatives Garrett Graves of Louisiana and Patrick McHenry of North Carolina. The White House negotiators left the Speaker's offices around 8:30 p.m. on Sunday night. Neither side provided reporters with any updates on the negotiations. Earlier on Sunday, President Biden said at the G7 summit that Republican leaders need to move from their extreme positions to achieve bipartisan consensus and characterize previous proposals as unacceptable. Representatives from the White House and the Speaker's office met briefly on Friday after stalling earlier in the day, but negotiations broke down and both sides left without a deal. On Saturday, Kevin McCarthy tweeted that the White House is moving backward in negotiations, while White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said McCarthy's team had submitted was a big step back and contained a set of extreme partisan demands that could never pass both houses of Congress. President Biden has cut several stops from the trip to continue talks with congressional leaders, as Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that the U.S. could be unable to pay its bills and default on its debt as soon as 1st of June. "I think we can solve some of these problems if he understands what we're looking at. But I've been very clear to him from the very beginning," Kevin McCarthy said. we have to spend less money than we spent last year. McCarthy didn't elaborate further about the outcome of his discussion, with President Biden saying nothing has been agreed to as yet. The White House issued a short readout of the call confirming Kevin McCarthy and President Biden's meeting on Monday. Before departing from Hiroshima, Japan, Biden said he had done my part in negotiating with Republicans, adding, "Now it's time for the other side to move their extreme positions because much of what they've already proposed is simply, quite frankly, unacceptable." Republicans want to raise the limit on the country's borrowing authority in exchange for spending cuts, while Democrats, including Biden, want to increase the debt limit without any conditions attached. President Biden insists raising or suspending the debt ceiling is Congress's responsibility to handle, while Republicans say Mr. Biden and Democrats on Capitol Hill must compromise on spending. On Face the Nation program on Sunday, Democratic Representative Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey said, "We can't continue to play chicken with the full faith and the credit of the United States of America." His Republican colleague, Representative Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, said he believed that 1st of June deadline may not be so strict. The website of National Public Radio, NPR.org, has also covered this story. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Biden met in person on Monday, 22nd of May, continuing discussions over the debt limit as the U.S. quickly approached the date at which it may no longer be able to pay its bills. Kevin McCarthy told reporters on Sunday morning that he had a productive phone call with President Biden, who was returning to Washington from Japan, where he attended the G7 summit. Kevin McCarthy told reporters top negotiators from his team and the president's will return to meetings on Sunday evening in advance of an in-person meeting between the speaker and the president on Monday, 22nd of May. The White House confirmed a phone call between the two leaders and a plan for Monday's meeting. "My discussion with the president, I think, was productive," McCarthy said. "Look, he's sitting on Air Force One, and he had been sitting in meetings with other world leaders, and it's hard to try to get that update as we're going across there. I think we can solve some of these problems if he understands what we're looking at. But I've been very clear to him from the very beginning. We have to spend less money than we spent last year." Kevin McCarthy stressed the two sides remain apart and that nothing is agreed to as yet. In recent days, the Biden administration and House Republicans have focused their public efforts on blaming the other side for the impasse on ways to prevent an unprecedented debt default. Speaking after the G7 meeting concluded, President Biden repeated his accusations that Republicans were to blame for the deadlock. "It's time for the other side to move off extreme positions because much of what they've already proposed is simply, quite frankly, unacceptable," he said. Biden said he was willing to cut spending, but said Republicans needed to consider raising tax revenues. House Republicans are largely opposed to any tax increase, a major tool that Biden has relied on in his proposed budgets to lower the deficit. Biden said he expected to speak to Kevin McCarthy on Air Force One. "My guess is he's going to want to deal directly with me in making sure we're all on the same page." Earlier on Sunday, Kevin McCarthy characterized the White House as moving backwards in the talks. The Associated Press has also covered the same story. The White House and House Republicans wrapped up another round of debt ceiling talks on Sunday as Washington races to strike a budget compromise along with a deal to raise the nation's borrowing limit and avert an economy-wrecking federal default. President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy spoke by phone on Sunday while the president was returning home on Air Force One after a group of seven, the G7 summit in Japan. The two met on Monday, 22nd of May, at the White House. "It went well. We'll talk tomorrow," Biden said of the phone call as he arrived back in Washington. Upbeat Kevin McCarthy told reporters at the Capitol that the phone call was productive and that the on-again, off-again negotiations between his staff and White House representatives are focused on spending cuts. Negotiators for the Democratic president and Republican speaker met for 2.5 hours at the Capitol Hill as talks appear to be narrowing on a 2024 budget year cap that would be key to resolving the standoff. "We'll keep working," said Steve Ricchetti, counselor to the president, as White House team exited Capitol Hill. The Republicans were not seen leaving the speaker's office and offered no immediate comment. They all face a deadline as soon as 1st of June, when the government could run out of cash to pay its bills. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said on Sunday that 1st of June is a hard deadline. Kevin McCarthy said after his call with President Biden, he said, "I think we can solve some of these problems if he understands what we're looking at." The speaker added, "But I've been very clear to him from the very beginning. We have to spend less money than we spent last year." McCarthy emerged from the conversation sounding optimistic and was careful not to criticize Biden's G7 trip, as he had before. He did caution, however, he said, "There is no agreement on anything as yet." Earlier, President Biden used his concluding news conference in Hiroshima, Japan, to warn House Republicans that they must move off their extreme positions over raising the debt limit and that there would be no agreement to avoid a catastrophic default, only on their terms.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Papua New Guinea has signed a defense and maritime cooperation agreement with the U.S. during the U.S. Pacific Islands Forum in Port Moresby. The agreement was signed by Defense Minister Win Bakridaki and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who flew into the country early on Monday in the place of U.S. President Joe Biden. In a meeting with PNG Prime Minister James Morope during the signing ceremony, Blinken said the United States would deepen its partnership across the board with the country.
The Defense Cooperation Agreement, drafted by Papua New Guinea and the United States as equal and sovereign partners, will enhance the PNG's Defense Forces capabilities to deliver humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, including through providing medical care and temporary shelter to those who are affected by crises.
Morope, for his part, hailed the deal as a mutually beneficial agreement.
Both sides have agreed that the agreement that we're signing today is doesn't offend Papua New Guinea law, doesn't offend USA law, is mutually beneficial, especially and for me in the context of Papua New Guinea. It secures our national interest to grow into becoming a robust economy in this part of the world. as we leave today and going forward.
PNG's Prime Minister James Moropa said that to implement the deal, there would be an increased presence of U.S. military personnel and contractors over the next 2 years. However, he insisted that the Americans will not establish a U.S. military base on the island. Moropa also denied reports that U.S. staff would have legal immunity and said no amendments would be made to the Constitution or laws of the country. That's after a leaked draft document suggested Port Moresby has given U.S. personnel and contractors legal immunity, allowing aircrafts, vehicles, and vessels operated by or on behalf of the U.S. to move freely within its territory and territorial waters, and exemptions for U.S. staff from all migration requirements. The U.S. State Department announced the new pact covers security, defense, and maritime surveillance, and would provide $45 million to help improve bilateral cooperation, including protective equipment for the Papua New Guinea Defense Force. PNG, with a population of nearly 10 million people, is the most populous Pacific Island nation located just north of Australia. The region has witnessed increasing militarization in past years, raising concerns among civil society groups. They accuse Moropa of setting the stage for future hostilities between the U.S. and China. PNG's former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill accused his successor of placing the country at the epicenter of a military storm between China and the U.S. by agreeing to enter into defense agreements with both superpowers without consultation with people. Also, opposition leader Joseph Lelang from the People's National Congress said last week, "We should not be blinded by the dollar sign or be coerced into signing deals that may be detrimental to us in the long run." He said the foreign policy of Papua New Guinea is friends to all and enemies to none. In the midst of growing rivalry between Washington and Beijing in the Pacific region, China has warned against geopolitical games in the South Pacific after the U.S. signed a security agreement with Papua New Guinea.
What we must be vigilant about is the use of cooperation as a pretext for engaging in geopolitical games, and we believe no cooperation should target third parties.
The foreign ministry spokesperson, however, stressed that China has no objection to normal exchanges and equal, mutually beneficial cooperation with Pacific Island nations, including Papua New Guinea. She said any negotiation and cooperation agreement should benefit regional peace, development, and stability. The Pacific nations manage around 20% of the world's oceans. These hugely important maritime routes were used in World War II to transport supplies to Australia and New Zealand. Western interests in the Pacific waned after the war, but Chinese investments in the region have grown. Beijing has worked to strengthen ties with several island nations over the last decade, sending aid and investing in schools, roads, and bridges. However, in recent years, the U.S. has been expanding its military presence in the Pacific as part of its strategic shift to East Asia, where it seeks to contain the growing power of China.
Mission accomplished. Iranian Navy's 86th flotilla has wrapped up its 8-month voyage and returned home. The flotilla, comprised of domestically manufactured Dana destroyer and Macron forward base ship, arrived at the southern port city of Bandar Abbas on Saturday. The naval fleet set sail on a mission around the world from Bandar Abbas in September 2022. The flotilla stopped at the port of Mumbai, India, and then docked in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after passing through the Bay of Bengal and the Strait of Malacca. The fleet continued its journey towards Java Sea and passed through the Strait of Makassar, arriving in the vast Pacific Ocean for the first time in the history of Iran's military seafaring. crossing the Pacific Ocean, the fleet moved toward the Strait of Magellan in the south of the Americas and entered the South Atlantic Ocean. The naval squadron also passed the coasts of Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and finally anchoring in the port of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. The flotilla then crossed the Atlantic Ocean and anchored in the city of Cape Town, South Africa. It then berthed in the coasts of Oman and finally sailed into the Iranian territorial waters. An official ceremony was held in Bandar Abbas to welcome the arrival of the naval fleet. Addressing the official homecoming ceremony of the flotilla, the chief of staff of the Iranian armed forces said the arrival of the 86th Naval Flotilla is a source of pride for the Iranian nation and a landmark accomplishment in the history of the country's naval missions. Major General Mohammad Hossein Bagheri said the flotilla concluded its historic voyage on the high seas to mark what he called an outstanding achievement despite Western-led sanctions against the Islamic Republic. General Bagheri said maritime prowess is among the most important factors of Iran's military might. He added, "We do not lack anything to achieve such an ideal and are gifted with homegrown industries for that purpose." He noted that the Iranian courageous commanders and marines undertake naval missions valiantly and fearlessly. The arrival of the naval fleet to Bandar Abbas comes as the unprecedented move of the Iranian Navy in carrying out such difficult missions ushers in a new era for the Iranian armed forces. As Major General Bagheri put it, the 86th Flotilla of the Navy fulfilled a historic mission. Even major countries in the world do not have the courage to undertake such a task. What makes the round-the-world mission significant, though, is the way Western countries, namely the United States, reacted to it. In February, the U.S. Treasury sanctioned the two ships while they were on the international voyage. According to Iranian officials, the U.S. has also failed to prevent the Iranian naval flotilla from sailing through the Panama Canal, an 82-kilometer waterway in Panama that connects the Atlantic Pacific Oceans. Iran's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, has said, quote, "The global arrogance tried to block the Iranian flotilla's mission through threats and sanctions, but the successful voyage marked another slap in their faces." The Navy commander also said that France claimed that the Iranian ships had entered its waters, but they changed course when they were reminded of their own shipping rules and regulations. All those reactions highlight Iran's naval prowess in international waters. In recent years, naval forces of the Islamic Republic have enhanced their presence throughout global waters to protect shipping routes and provide security for merchant vessels and tankers. The Iranian Navy has also regularly carried out patrols in the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean to fight piracy in an effort to secure vessels commuting in international waters, not to mention that numerous attacks on Iranian or foreign vessels have been thwarted by the Iranian Navy in recent years. All in all, the unprecedented voyage by the 86th Flotilla not only has shown Iran's maritime capabilities, but drove home the point that the language of threat and force does not work with Iran, as it is committed to asserting its strength in international waters and providing security to its vessels. Thousands have rallied in the besieged Gaza Strip to commemorate the martyrdom of several commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement during the recent Israeli aggression on the coastal territory. The rally also honored those civilians who fell victim to the regime's onslaught earlier this month. The demonstrators vowed to maintain their resistance in the face of the regime's atrocities against Palestinians. In an address to the ralliers, one of the leaders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, Khalid al-Batch, remembered the group's commanders who were assassinated during the five-day Israeli onslaught. Batch said, "We want to tell the whole world that though the F-16 airstrikes and the American 139 rockets were fired toward us, this nation is still alive and will continue the resistance." He said, "We attest our right to freedom. From their blood, we'll continue the resistance. From their death, we received the power to face the Zionists. We will continue." Meanwhile, a similar event was held in the Syrian capital Damascus, where Islamic Jihad Secretary General addressed ralliers. Ziad al-Nakhala hailed the Palestinians' victory against Israel during the regime's recent aggression against Gaza. He said the regime was forced to accept Palestinians' terms for a ceasefire in the face of hundreds of rockets fired into the occupied territories. Nakhala added that Palestinians dealt another hefty blow to Israel's already tarnished image. The official attributed the Palestinian victory to their unity and sacrifices. Nakhala vowed a strong and painful response to any future Israeli assassination of the group's commanders. The recent Israeli aggression on Gaza started on May 9th with the regime launching a devastating campaign of deadly bombings targeting senior commanders of the Islamic Jihad and their families. The Islamic Jihad, in response, fired barrages of rockets toward the occupied territories. The conflict marked the worst episode of fighting between Gaza's resistance factions and the Israeli regime since the 10-day war imposed by Tel Aviv on Gaza in 2021. After 5 days, the two sides agreed to an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire that took effect on May the 13th. But flashing back to some of Israeli-Palestinian conflicts since 2000, one would find that the Palestinian resistance has been gaining momentum ever since. Testimony to that claim is that according to figures, from September 2000 to December 2006, over 1,000 rockets were fired into the occupied territories. The rockets were all fired in response to the killing of 80 Palestinians by the Israeli regime. In 2008, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas carried out rocket-fired and mortar attacks against targets across the occupied territories, hitting previously untargeted cities such as Beersheba and Ashdod. That also in response to the killing of plus 1,000 Palestinians. In 2014, the Israeli regime carried out its deadliest aggression on Gaza, killing more than 2,000 Palestinians, including 1,400 civilians according to UN figures. That onslaught also prompted one of the deadliest Palestinian retaliations against Israel, with more than 70 Israelis being killed. All those powerful retaliations bring to the spotlight the power and strength the Palestinian resistance has attained during the past 2 decades or so. With the Israeli officials admitting that the Islamic Jihad fired 1,000 rockets toward the occupied territories during the recent Israeli-Gaza aggression, it goes without saying that the Palestinian resistance has indeed gained momentum. Maybe that's why resistance movements like Islamic Jihad has come to the understanding that resistance, in fact, is a national duty which is based on the legitimate right of Palestinians to fight against the Israeli regime, something that has proven to be the only successful deterrent against Israeli aggressions.
The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad at the Arab League summit, his one-time enemy Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman seen here greeting him. A symbolic moment, sealing Assad's reintegration into the Arab fold after being suspended from the League and isolated by most of the region for over a decade. A man who wanted him dethroned, who supported terrorist groups with the sole aim of toppling him. But now, that is wonder under the bridge. Assad lining up for the League's family photograph. Every handshake, confirmation of his reintegration. One after the other, Arab leaders welcoming Syria's reintegration, and during his own address, Assad repeatedly said that Syria belonged to the Arab world. There have been words of condemnation against Saudi Arabia and the Arab League normalizing ties, rhetoric from the losing end of the so-called Syrian opposition, something that should be shelved in the archives, for there is a new reality taking shape in West Asia. The Arab League Secretary General made sure to relay that message. Saudi Arabia is now a firm believer that security cannot be bought and that countries in this region can establish their own security. The Saudi Foreign Minister, Prince Faisal bin Farham, called for cooperation between Arab countries to achieve security, stability, and economic prosperity. West Asian security, however, does not serve the interests of the U.S. All of these reconciliations with Syria is shunned and rejected by the U.S. The decision to readmit Syria to the Arab League represents a rejection of U.S. interests. The Arab rush to welcome Damascus back into the fold has happened despite public objections from the U.S. U.S. efforts at easing Mr. Assad out and replacing him with an inclusive, democratic government have gone nowhere, leaving American officials on the sidelines. That is one view. However, additionally, U.S. lawmakers are proposing a bill that would prohibit Washington from either recognizing or normalizing relations with any Syrian government led by Assad. The legislation is also a warning to Turkey and Arab countries that if they engage with Assad's government, they could face severe consequences. But who's listening? Challenges do remain. Arab countries are keen to invest in Syria, especially in its reconstruction. But the U.S. legislation built upon the Caesar Syria Civilian Protection Act, a 2019 law that authorized sanctions on those who do business with the Syrian government. Then there's the issue of Israel, who has continued bombing Syria. How will Arab countries deal with Israel when it comes to Syria? Israel is one of the sorest losers in this, since now there's a stronger united front in the form of an axis of resistance against Israel. On the one hand, the U.S., who is occupying Syrian soil and stealing and selling its oil, is an outsider, accompanied by the Israeli regime, which has no cards left to unify Arab countries against Iran. Nevertheless, China's view on the diminished U.S. role in the region, which closely mirrors Iran's stance, has said it best. Syria's Arab League reintegration, proof that when the U.S. shadow shrinks, peace spreads.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
Heading a high-ranking political economic delegation, Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi has visited Indonesia in response to the invitation of Indonesian President Joko Widodo. In this regard, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has penned an article on the significance of this trip, which was published by Indonesia's English-language newspaper, The Jakarta Post. What you are about to hear is the full text of this piece. Please stay with us. The state visit of the Islamic Republic of Iran President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi to Jakarta in response to the invitation of President Joko Widodo marks not only a turning point in the bilateral relations between the two countries, but also the commencement of a new chapter in the relations between the two great nations. The stance of the two countries in the two regions of the West Asia region and East Asia, cultural and civilizational commonalities and weighty potential for cooperation in various fields, alongside the new requirements of the international order, herald the opening of a new era of relations between the two countries, hinged on respect and mutual understanding. The diplomatic ties between Iran and Indonesia are now entering their eighth decade, while the relations between the two great nations have deep roots in history. The people of the two countries
centuries ago, were able to establish profound bonds with each other through Islam, and Iranian and Indonesian Muslim scholars and intellectuals had beneficial interactions in past centuries. The linguistic ties between the two countries also serve as further evidence of the historical interactions between the people of the two nations throughout Asia. A considerable number of Persian words in the Indonesian language and shared assets such as Imam Muhammad Ghazali testify to the depth of historical connections between them and provide a basis for deepening the relations between the two nations. The Islamic Republic of Iran, within the framework of a balanced, smart, and dynamic foreign policy, attaches a special prominence to the development of relations with Indonesia. Fortunately, this determination exists on both sides, and the authorities of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of Indonesia are resolute to create the required infrastructure and facilities for the development of relations in various fields. The bilateral negotiations between the two countries encompass a wide range of bilateral, regional, and international topics. Iran and Indonesia seek to deepen cooperation in various areas, including political, economic, trade, energy, scientific and technological, cultural, parliamentary, and security fields. Despite the excellent relations, constructive cooperation, and mutual support in international forums, it must be acknowledged the current volume of trade relations between the two countries is below expectations given the available capacities. Therefore, President Raisi and his accompanying delegation in this journey to Jakarta provide a valuable opportunity for the public and private sectors of both countries to become more familiar with each other's economic and commercial capacities and capabilities. The links between Iran and Indonesia within the framework of South-South cooperation have a historical background and demonstrate the common approach of the two countries to create a balanced world. The two countries have common positions on regional, international, and Islamic issues, and continuous negotiations between the two sides on these matters are ongoing. Recognizing the need to strengthen regional relations, we commend the performance of ASEAN and emphasize the Islamic Republic of Iran's willingness to develop relations with other member states of the regional bloc within the framework of the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation signed between the two sides in 2017. We consider Indonesia's chairmanship in ASEAN an optimal opportunity for developing relations with the other member states of this progressive grouping. We also welcome the possibility of regional connections between ASEAN and the Economic Cooperation Organization, ECCO, in West Asia. Issues such as the necessity of unity among Islamic countries, promoting the true image of Islam in the world, combating extremism and Islamophobia, and supporting the interests of Muslims worldwide, including the oppressed Palestinian people, are the points that align the foreign policy of the two countries on a common path. Within this framework, we believe the West Asian countries, as an environment with the highest number of Islamic countries, can overcome existing misunderstandings, and regardless of the intervention of non-regional powers, establish an intra-regional order. Negotiations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia are taking place in this regard. We believe the two countries have embarked on the right path, and this understanding will bring tangible results for the stability and prosperity of the region and the Islamic world.
As an influential bloc in global equations, the Islamic world requires greater convergence to create opportunities for consensus, synergy, and the generation of innovative ideas benefiting the great Ummah, worldwide Islamic community. Undoubtedly, countries that have noteworthy weight in the Islamic world can play a leading role in realizing the interests of the Ummah. Based on this, Iran welcomes the strengthening of cooperation with Indonesia as one of the essential and influential predominantly Muslim countries in the world. From the perspective of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the unilateralism prevailing in the world with the elimination of multilateral mechanisms and its detrimental effects on global peace and security has now been marginalized. In other words, the security of the international system does not have a prescribed nature and has been transformed into a synergic and participatory matter with the maximum involvement of actors. The founding fathers of the historic Bandung Conference and the proponents of the paradigm of non-alignment decades ago rightly took steps in this direction and expressed their opposition to any polarization that would endanger world peace and stability. In the new international context, developing and emerging countries, through cooperation and shared efforts, can play a constructive role in ensuring global peace and stability, including in the areas of food security and energy. In conclusion, I would like to emphasize the serious commitment of the authorities in my country to the development of relations with the friendly and brotherly country of Indonesia. Indonesians are noble and hospitable, and I am deeply pleased we are in Indonesia accompanying President Raisi. I wish felicity, prosperity, and progress for Indonesia's government and great people.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on April 18th, 2023.
Another example about trying to make us pessimistic about ourselves is the existence of all kinds of malicious media outlets that insist on proving that the Iranian nation has turned away from religious beliefs and that it has turned away from revolutionary sentiments. They insist on this. They say this over and over again. And they have some followers here who say the same thing. They repeat in the social media, in newspapers, and in various discussions that people have turned away from religion. Well, they repeat this. If a person is negligent and not thinking, he or she will accept and believe in this. But suddenly you see that the Qadr night arrives and this year's gatherings are more energetic than last year. Besieging God, crying, imploring him, as well as the presence of young people and their tears and these gatherings were more than last year's. Quds Day arrives and it's more crowded than last year. The 22nd of Bahman arrives and the crowd is double that of last year. This means that the opposite of what they say is true, but they tempt others.
دنیا
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I said from the Quran, against the evil of the temptations of the Satans, who whisper into the hearts of human beings, from among the jinn and human beings. Chapter 114, verse 6. The human beings who I referred to here are these people. They are always tempting others. As another example, imagine a few investors and entrepreneurs leave the country with their money and move to another country. Some people say, see, why do you have hope that you can carry out any kind of economic activity here? They are leaving. Well, yes, if there are four people leaving, there are another 40 people staying and running their businesses. There are thousands of knowledge-based companies being created that are employing our youth. This is the truth of our society, but the enemies try their best to eliminate everyone's hope. This is the enemy's strategy. So keep in mind that the enemy's plan today is to cause us lose hope in ourselves. They want us to lose hope in ourselves, lose hope in the government, lose hope in student environments, and to lose hope in our people. But no, the country is making progress, and it is progressing well.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Across France, top unions led another day of strikes aimed at winning the revocation of a recent 2-year hike to the retirement age. With President Emmanuel Macron refusing to budge, many are now demanding the movement expand into a complete general strike.
We must have a general strike to create a new system of society, as our current model allows the government and the bosses to totally ignore our needs. Everybody must get involved because everybody is affected.
Many speculate that Macron is so isolated from everyday French society that he may not understand how resentful the public mood is following one austerity measure after another since 2010.
Macron doesn't listen to us, but what's worse is that he looks down on us. He still doesn't care about all the protesting, so that's why our goal has to be to block the entire economy with a general strike. That will get his attention.
The general strike of 2019-2020 was the nation's longest labor action ever, but it ultimately failed. The strike shaved only 0.1% off of French economic growth that quarter, showing that a general strike's most powerful aspect may be its ability to shame and discredit those in power. The biggest economic impact of striking is felt by the workers. The pre-COVID general strike failed because so many workers were just too impoverished to continue a strike that had lasted almost 2 months.
The government did all it could to stretch the general strike out, as their plan was to exhaust the strikers financially. They're using the same tactic now, and that's why we saw more than 4 months of massive protests before they even met with unions to discuss the age hike.
This spring has seen record strikes in other European nations, such as Belgium, Germany, Spain, and even the United Kingdom. Low salaries, record inflation, and perceptions that their governments refuse to democratically recognize the scope of the hardship are all consistently cited as reasons. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The right to go on strike, to withdraw one's labor over